Chapter 1. About 30 years ago, Miss Maria Ward, of Huntingdon, with only £7,000, had the good luck to captivate Sir Thomas Bertram, of Mansfield Park, in the county of Northampton, and to be thereby raised to the rank of a baronet's lady, with all the comforts and consequences of an handsome house and large income. All Huntingdon exclaimed on the greatness of the match, and her uncle, the lawyer, himself, allowed her to be at least £3,000 short of any equitable claim to it. She had two sisters to be benefited by her elevation, and such of their acquaintance as thought Miss Ward and Miss Frances quite as handsome as Miss Maria, did not scruple to predict their marrying with almost equal advantage. But there certainly are not so many men of large fortune in the world as there are pretty women to deserve them. Miss Ward, at the end of half a dozen years, found herself obliged to be attached to the Reverend Mr. Norris, a friend of her brother-in-law, with scarcely any private fortune, and Miss Frances fared yet worse. Miss Ward's match, indeed, when it came to the point, was not contemptible, Sir Thomas being happily able to give his friend an income in the living of Mansfield, and Mr. and Mrs. Norris began their career of conjugal felicity with very little less than £1,000 a year. But Miss Frances married, in the common phrase, to disoblige her family, and by fixing on a lieutenant of marines, without education, fortune, or connections, did it very thoroughly. She could hardly have made a more untoward choice. Sir Thomas Bertram had interest, which, from principle as well as pride, from a general wish of doing right, and a desire of seeing all that were connected with him in situations of respectability, he would have been glad to exert for the advantage of Lady Bertram's sister, but her husband's profession was such as no interest could reach, and before he had time to devise any other method of assisting them, an absolute breach between the sisters had taken place. It was the natural result of the conduct of each party, and such as a very imprudent marriage almost always produces. To save herself from useless remonstrance, Mrs. Price never wrote to her family on the subject till actually married. Lady Bertram, who was a woman of very tranquil feelings, and a temper remarkably easy and indolent, would have contented herself with merely giving up her sister, and thinking no more of the matter, but Mrs. Norris had a spirit of activity, which could not be satisfied till she had written a long and angry letter to Fanny, to point out the folly of her conduct, and threaten her with all its possible ill consequences. Mrs. Price, in her turn, was injured and angry, and an answer, which comprehended each sister in its bitterness, and bestowed such very disrespectful reflections on the pride of Sir Thomas as Mrs. Norris could not possibly keep to herself, put an end to all intercourse between them for a considerable period. Their homes were so distant, and the circles in which they moved so distinct, as almost to preclude the means of ever hearing of each other's existence during the 11 following years, or, at least, to make it very wonderful to Sir Thomas that Mrs. Norris should ever have it in her power to tell them, as she now and then did, in an angry voice, that Fanny had got another child. By the end of 11 years, however, Mrs. Price could no longer afford to cherish pride or resentment, or to lose one connection that might possibly assist her. A large and still increasing family, and husband disabled for active service, but not the less equal to company and good liquor, and a very small income to supply their wants, made her eager to regain the friends she had so carelessly sacrificed, and she addressed Lady Bertram in a letter which spoke so much contrition and despondence, such a superfluity of children, and such a want of almost everything else, as could not but dispose them all to a reconciliation. She was preparing for her 9th lying in, and after bewailing the circumstance, and imploring their countenance as sponsors to the expected child, she could not conceal how important she felt they might be to the future maintenance of the 8 already in being. Her eldest was a boy of 10 years old, a fine-spirited fellow, who longed to be out in the world, but what could she do? Was there any chance of his being hereafter useful to Sir Thomas in the concerns of his West Indian property? No situation would be beneath him, or what did Sir Thomas think of Woolwich? Or how could a boy be sent out to the East? The letter was not unproductive. It re-established peace and kindness. Sir Thomas sent friendly advice and professions, Lady Bertram dispatched money and baby linen, and Mrs. Norris wrote the letters. Such were its immediate effects, and within a 12-month a more important advantage to Mrs. Price resulted from it. Mrs. Norris was often observing to the others that she could not get her poor sister and her family out of her head, and that, much as they had all done for her, she seemed to be wanting to do more, and at length she could not but own it to be her wish that poor Mrs. Price should be relieved from the charge and expense of one child entirely out of her great number. What if they were among them to undertake the care of her eldest daughter, a girl now 9 years old, of an age to require more attention than her poor mother could possibly give? The trouble and expense of it to them would be nothing, compared with the benevolence of the action. Lady Bertram agreed with her instantly. "I think we cannot do better," said she. "Let us send for the child." Sir Thomas could not give so instantaneous and unqualified a consent. He debated and hesitated. It was a serious charge. A girl so brought up must be adequately provided for, or there would be cruelty instead of kindness in taking her from her family. He thought of his own four children, of his two sons, of cousins in love, etc., but no sooner had he deliberately begun to state his objections, than Mrs. Norris interrupted him with a reply to them all, whether stated or not. "My dear Sir Thomas, I perfectly comprehend you, and do justice to the generosity and delicacy of your notions, which indeed are quite of a piece with your general conduct, and I entirely agree with you in the main as to the propriety of doing everything one could by way of providing for a child one had in a manner taken into one's own hands, and I am sure I should be the last person in the world to withhold my mite upon such an occasion. Having no children of my own, who should I look to in any little matter I may ever have to bestow, but the children of my sisters? And I am sure Mr. Norris is too just, but you know I am a woman of few words and professions. Do not let us be frightened from a good deed by a trifle. Give a girl an education, and introduce her properly into the world, and 10 to 1 but she has the means of settling well, without farther expense to anybody. A niece of ours, Sir Thomas, I may say, or at least of yours, would not grow up in this neighborhood without many advantages. I don't say she would be so handsome as her cousins. I dare say she would not. But she would be introduced into the society of this country under such very favorable circumstances as, in all human probability, would get her a creditable establishment. You are thinking of your sons, but do not you know that, of all things upon earth, that is the least likely to happen, brought up as they would be, always together like brothers and sisters? It is morally impossible. I never knew an instance of it. It is, in fact, the only sure way of providing against the connection. Suppose her a pretty girl, and seen by Tom or Edmund for the first time 7 years hence, and I dare say there would be mischief. The very idea of her having been suffered to grow up at a distance from us all in poverty and neglect, would be enough to make either of the dear, sweet-tempered boys in love with her. But breed her up with them from this time, and suppose her even to have the beauty of an angel, and she will never be more to either than a sister. There is a great deal of truth in what you say, replied Sir Thomas, and far be it from me to throw any fanciful impediment in the way of a plan which would be so consistent with the relative situations of each. I only meant to observe that it ought not to be lightly engaged in, and that to make it really serviceable to Mrs. Price, and creditable to ourselves, we must secure to the child, or consider ourselves engaged to secure to her hereafter, as circumstances may arise, the provision of a gentlewoman, if no such establishment should offer as you are so sanguine in expecting. I thoroughly understand you, cried Mrs. Norris. You are everything that is generous and considerate, and I am sure we shall never disagree on this point. Whatever I can do, as you well know, I am always ready enough to do for the good of those I love, and, though I could never feel for this little girl the 1/100th part of the regard I bear your own dear children, nor consider her, in any respect, so much my own, I should hate myself if I were capable of neglecting her. Is not she a sister's child? And could I bear to see her want while I had a bit of bread to give her? My dear Sir Thomas, with all my faults I have a warm heart, and, poor as I am, would rather deny myself the necessaries of life than do an ungenerous thing. So, if you are not against it, I will write to my poor sister tomorrow, and make the proposal, and, as soon as matters are settled, I will engage to get the child to Mansfield. You shall have no trouble about it. My own trouble, you know, I never regard. I will send Nanny to London on purpose, and she may have a bed at her cousin the saddler's, and the child be appointed to meet her there. They may easily get her from Portsmouth to town by the coach, under the care of any creditable person that may chance to be going. I dare say there is always some reputable tradesman's wife or other going up. Except to the attack on Nanny's cousin, Sir Thomas no longer made any objection, and a more respectable, though less economical rendezvous being accordingly substituted, everything was considered as settled, and the pleasures of so benevolent a scheme were already enjoyed. The division of gratifying sensations ought not, in strict justice, to have been equal, for Sir Thomas was fully resolved to be the real and consistent patron of this elected child, and Mrs. Norris had not the least intention of being at any expense whatever in her maintenance. As far as walking, talking, and contriving reached, she was thoroughly benevolent, and nobody knew better how to dictate liberality to others, but her love of money was equal to her love of directing, and she knew quite as well how to save her own as to spend that of her friends. Having married on a narrower income than she had been used to look forward to, she had, from the first, fancied a very strict line of economy necessary, and what was begun as a matter of prudence, soon grew into a matter of choice, as an object of that needful solicitude which there were no children to supply. Had there been a family to provide for, Mrs. Norris might never have saved her money, but having no care of that kind, there was nothing to impede her frugality, or lessen the comfort of making a yearly addition to an income which they had never lived up to. Under this infatuating principle, counteracted by no real affection for her sister, it was impossible for her to aim at more than the credit of projecting and arranging so expensive a charity, though perhaps she might so little know herself as to walk home to the parsonage, after this conversation, in the happy belief of being the most liberal-minded sister and aunt in the world. When the subject was brought forward again, her views were more fully explained, and, in reply to Lady Bertram's calm inquiry of where shall the child come to first, sister, to you or to us? Sir Thomas heard with some surprise that it would be totally out of Mrs. Norris's power to take any share in the personal charge of her. He had been considering her as a particularly welcome addition at the parsonage, as a desirable companion to an aunt who had no children of her own, but he found himself wholly mistaken. Mrs. Norris was sorry to say that the little girl staying with him, at least as things then were, was quite out of the question. Poor Mr. Norris's indifferent state of health made it an impossibility. He could no more bear the noise of a child than he could fly. If, indeed, he should ever get well of his gouty complaints, it would be a different matter. She should then be glad to take her turn, and think nothing of the inconvenience. But just now, poor Mr. Norris took up every moment of her time, and the very mention of such a thing she was sure would distract him. "Then she had better come to us," said Lady Bertram, with the utmost composure. After a short pause, Sir Thomas added with dignity, "Yes, let her home be in this house. We will endeavor to do our duty by her, and she will, at least, have the advantage of companions of her own age, and of a regular instructress." "Very true," cried Mrs. Norris, "which are both very important considerations, and it will be just the same to Miss Lee whether she has three girls to teach, or only two. There can be no difference. I only wish I could be more useful, but you see I do all in my power. I am not one of those that spare their own trouble, and Nanny shall fetch her, however it may put me to inconvenience to have my chief counselor away for 3 days. I suppose, sister, you will put the child in the little white attic, near the old nurseries. It will be much the best place for her, so near Miss Lee, and not far from the girls, and close by the housemaids, who could either of them help to dress her, you know, and take care of her clothes, for I suppose you would not think it fair to expect Alice to wait on her as well as the others. Indeed, I do not see that you could possibly place her anywhere else." Lady Bertram made no opposition. "I hope she will prove a well-disposed girl," continued Mrs. Norris, "and be sensible of her uncommon good fortune in having such friends." "Should her disposition be really bad," said Sir Thomas, "we must not, for our own children's sake, continue her in the family, but there is no reason to expect so great an evil. We shall probably see much to wish altered in her, and must prepare ourselves for gross ignorance, some meanness of opinions, and very distressing vulgarity of manner, but these are not incurable faults, nor, I trust, can they be dangerous for her associates. Had my daughters been younger than herself, I should have considered the introduction of such a companion as a matter of very serious moment, but, as it is, I hope there can be nothing to fear for them, and everything to hope for her, from the association." "That is exactly what I think," cried Mrs. Norris, "and what I was saying to my husband this morning. It will be an education for the child," said I, "only being with her cousins, if Miss Lee taught her nothing, she would learn to be good and clever from them." "I hope she will not tease my poor pug," said Lady Bertram, "I have but just got Juliet to leave it alone." "There will be some difficulty in our way, Mrs. Norris," observed Sir Thomas, "as to the distinction proper to be made between the girls as they grow up, how to preserve in the minds of my daughters the consciousness of what they are, without making them think too lowly of their cousin, and how, without depressing her spirits too far, to make her remember that she is not a Miss Bertram. I should wish to see them very good friends, and would, on no account, authorize in my girls the smallest degree of arrogance towards their relation, but still they cannot be equals. Their rank, fortune, rights, and expectations will always be different. It is a point of great delicacy, and you must assist us in our endeavors to choose exactly the right line of conduct." Mrs. Norris was quite at his service, and though she perfectly agreed with him as to its being a most difficult thing, encouraged him to hope that between them it would be easily managed. It will be readily believed that Mrs. Norris did not write to her sister in vain. Mrs. Price seemed rather surprised that a girl should be fixed on, when she had so many fine boys, but accepted the offer most thankfully, assuring them of her daughter's being a very well-disposed, good-humored girl, and trusting they would never have cause to throw her off. She spoke of her father as somewhat delicate and puny, but was sanguine in the hope of her being materially better for change of air. Poor woman. She probably thought change of air might agree with many of her children. Chapter 2. The little girl performed her long journey in safety, and at Northampton was met by Mrs. Norris, who thus regaled in the credit of being foremost to welcome her, and in the importance of leading her into the others, and recommending her to their kindness. Fanny Price was at this time just 10 years old, and though there might not be much in her first appearance to captivate, there was, at least, nothing to disgust her relations. She was small of her age, with no glow of complexion, nor any other striking beauty, exceedingly timid and shy, and shrinking from notice, but her air, though awkward, was not vulgar, her voice was sweet, and when she spoke her countenance was pretty. Sir Thomas and Lady Bertram received her very kindly, and Sir Thomas, seeing how much she needed encouragement, tried to be all that was conciliating, but he had to work against a most untoward gravity of deportment, and Lady Bertram, without taking half so much trouble, or speaking one word where he spoke 10, by the mere aid of a good-humored smile, became immediately the less awful character of the two. The young people were all at home, and sustained their share in the introduction very well, with much good humor, and no embarrassment, at least on the part of the sons, who, at 17 and 16, and tall of their age, had all the grandeur of men in the eyes of their little cousin. The two girls were more at a loss from being younger and in greater awe of their father, who addressed them on the occasion with rather an injudicious particularity. But they were too much used to company and praise to have anything like natural shyness, and their confidence increasing from their cousin's total want of it, they were soon able to take a full survey of her face and her frock in easy indifference. They were a remarkably fine family, the sons very well-looking, the daughters decidedly handsome, and all of them well-grown and forward of their age, which produced as striking a difference between the cousins in person, as education had given to their address, and no one would have supposed the girls so nearly of an age as they really were. There were in fact but 2 years between the youngest and Fanny. Julia Bertram was only 12, and Maria but a year older. The little visitor meanwhile was as unhappy as possible. Afraid of everybody, ashamed of herself, and longing for the home she had left, she knew not how to look up, and could scarcely speak to be heard, or without crying. Mrs. Norris had been talking to her the whole way from Northampton of her wonderful good fortune, and the extraordinary degree of gratitude and good behavior which it ought to produce, and her consciousness of misery was therefore increased by the idea of its being a wicked thing for her not to be happy. The fatigue, too, of so long a journey, became soon no trifling evil. In vain were the well-meant condescensions of Sir Thomas, and all the officious prognostications of Mrs. Norris that she would be a good girl, in vain did Lady Bertram smile and make her sit on the sofa with herself and Pug, and vain was even the sight of a gooseberry tart towards getting her comfort. She could scarcely swallow two mouthfuls before tears interrupted her, and sleep seeming to be her likeliest friend, she was taken to finish her sorrows in bed. "This is not a very promising beginning," said Mrs. Norris, when Fanny had left the room. "After all that I said to her as we came along, I thought she would have behaved better. I told her how much might depend upon her acquitting herself well at first. I wish there may not be a little sulkiness of temper. Her poor mother had a good deal, but we must make allowances for such a child, and I do not know that her being sorry to leave her home is really against her, for, with all its faults, it was her home, and she cannot as yet understand how much she has changed for the better, but then there is moderation in all things." It required a longer time, however, than Mrs. Norris was inclined to allow, to reconcile Fanny to the novelty of Mansfield Park, and the separation from everybody she had been used to. Her feelings were very acute, and too little understood to be properly attended to. Nobody meant to be unkind, but nobody put themselves out of their way to secure her comfort. The holiday allowed to the Miss Bertrams the next day, on purpose to afford leisure for getting acquainted with, and entertaining their young cousin, produced little union. They could not but hold her cheap on finding that she had but 2 sashes, and had never learned French, and when they perceived her to be little struck with the duet they were so good as to play, they could do no more than make her a generous present of some of their least valued toys, and leave her to herself, while they adjourned to whatever might be the favorite holiday sport of the moment, making artificial flowers or wasting gold paper. Fanny, whether near or from her cousins, whether in the schoolroom, the drawing room, or the shrubbery, was equally forlorn, finding something to fear in every person and place. She was disheartened by Lady Bertram's silence, awed by Sir Thomas's grave looks, and quite overcome by Mrs. Norris's admonitions. Her elder cousins mortified her by reflections on her size, and abashed her by noticing her shyness. Miss Lee wondered at her ignorance, and the maidservants sneered at her clothes, and when to these sorrows was added the idea of the brothers and sisters among whom she had always been important as playfellow, instructress, and nurse, the despondence that sunk her little heart was severe. The grandeur of the house astonished, but could not console her. The rooms were too large for her to move in with ease. Whatever she touched she expected to injure, and she crept about in constant terror of something or other, often retreating towards her own chamber to cry. And the little girl who was spoken of in the drawing room when she left it at night as seeming so desirably sensible of her peculiar good fortune, ended every day's sorrows by sobbing herself to sleep. A week had passed in this way, and no suspicion of it conveyed by her quiet passive manner, when she was found one morning by her cousin Edmund, the youngest of the sons, sitting crying on the attic stairs. "My dear little cousin," said he, with all the gentleness of an excellent nature, "what can be the matter?" And sitting down by her, he was at great pains to overcome her shame in being so surprised, and persuade her to speak openly. Was she ill? Or was anybody angry with her? Or had she quarreled with Maria and Julia? Or was she puzzled about anything in her lesson that he could explain? Did she, in short, want anything he could possibly get her, or do for her? For a long while no answer could be obtained beyond a no, no, not at all, no, thank you, but he still persevered, and no sooner had he begun to revert to her own home, then her increased sobs explained to him where the grievance lay. He tried to console her. "You are sorry to leave Mama, my dear little Fanny," said he, "which shows you to be a very good girl, but you must remember that you are with relations and friends, who all love you, and wish to make you happy. Let us walk out in the park, and you shall tell me all about your brothers and sisters." On pursuing the subject, he found that, dear as all these brothers and sisters generally were, there was one among them who ran more in her thoughts than the rest. It was William whom she talked of most, and wanted most to see. William, the eldest, a year older than herself, her constant companion and friend, her advocate with her mother, of whom he was the darling, in every distress. William did not like she should come away, he had told her he should miss her very much indeed. "But William will write to you, I dare say." Yes, he had promised he would, but he had told her to write first. "And when shall you do it?" She hung her head and answered hesitatingly, she did not know, she had not any paper. "If that be all your difficulty, I will furnish you with paper and every other material, and you may write your letter whenever you choose. Would it make you happy to write to William?"
"Yes, very."
"Then let it be done now. Come with me into the breakfast room, we shall find everything there, and be sure of having the room to ourselves."
"But, cousin, will it go to the post?"
"Yes, depend upon me it shall. It shall go with the other letters, and, as your uncle will frank it will cost William nothing."
"My uncle?" repeated Fanny, with a frightened look.
"Yes, when you have written the letter, I will take it to my father to frank." Fanny thought it a bold measure, but offered no further resistance, and they went together into the breakfast room, where Edmund prepared her paper, and ruled her lines with all the goodwill that her brother could himself have felt, and probably with somewhat more exactness. He continued with her the whole time of her writing, to assist her with his penknife or his orthography, as either were wanted, and added to these attentions, which she felt very much, a kindness to her brother which delighted her beyond all the rest. He wrote with his own hand his love to his cousin William, and sent him half a guinea under the seal. Fanny's feelings on the occasion were such as she believed herself incapable of expressing, but her countenance and a few artless words fully conveyed all their gratitude and delight. And her cousin began to find her an interesting object. He talked to her more, and, from all that she said, was convinced of her having an affectionate heart, and a strong desire of doing right, and he could perceive her to be farther entitled to attention by great sensibility of her situation, and great timidity. He had never knowingly given her pain, but he now felt that she required more positive kindness, and with that view endeavored, in the first place, to lessen her fears of them all, and gave her especially a great deal of good advice as to playing with Maria and Julia, and being as merry as possible. From this day Fanny grew more comfortable. She felt that she had a friend, and the kindness of her cousin Edmund gave her better spirits with everybody else. The place became less strange, and the people less formidable, and if there were some amongst them whom she could not cease to fear, she began at least to know their ways, and to catch the best manner of conforming to them.
The little rusticities and awkwardnesses which had at first made grievous inroads on the tranquility of all, and not least of herself, necessarily wore away, and she was no longer materially afraid to appear before her uncle, nor did her aunt Norris's voice make her start very much. To her cousins she became occasionally an acceptable companion, though unworthy, from inferiority of age and strength, to be their constant associate. Their pleasures and schemes were sometimes of a nature to make a third very useful, especially when that third was of an obliging, yielding temper, and they could not but own, when their aunt inquired into her faults, or their brother Edmund urged her claims to their kindness, that Fanny was good-natured enough. Edmund was uniformly kind himself, and she had nothing worse to endure on the part of Tom than that sort of merriment which a young man of 17 will always think fair with a child of 10. He was just entering into life, full of spirits, and with all the liberal dispositions of an eldest son, who feels born only for expense and enjoyment. His kindness to his little cousin was consistent with his situation and rights. He made her some very pretty presents, and laughed at her. As her appearance and spirits improved, Sir Thomas and Mrs. Norris thought with greater satisfaction of their benevolent plan, and it was pretty soon decided between them that, though far from clever, she showed a tractable disposition, and seemed likely to give them little trouble. A mean opinion of her abilities was not confined to them. Fanny could read, work, and write, but she had been taught nothing more, and as her cousins found her ignorant of many things with which they had been long familiar, they thought her prodigiously stupid, and for the first 2 or 3 weeks were continually bringing some fresh report of it into the drawing-room. "Dear Mama, only think, my cousin cannot put the map of Europe together, or my cousin cannot tell the principal rivers in Russia, or she never heard of Asia Minor, or she does not know the difference between watercolors and crayons. How strange! Did you ever hear anything so stupid?" "My dear," their considerate aunt would reply, "it is very bad, but you must not expect everybody to be as forward and quick at learning as yourself." "But, aunt, she is really so very ignorant. Do you know, we asked her last night which way she would go to get to Ireland, and she said, she should cross to the Isle of Wight. She thinks of nothing but the Isle of Wight, and she calls it the island, as if there were no other island in the world. I'm sure I should have been ashamed of myself, if I had not known better long before I was so old as she is. I cannot remember the time when I did not know a great deal that she has not the least notion of yet. How long ago it is, aunt, since we used to repeat the chronological order of the kings of England, with the dates of their accession, and most of the principal events of their reigns." "Yes," added the other, "and of the Roman emperors as low as Severus, besides a great deal of the heathen mythology, and all the metals, semi-metals, planets, and distinguished philosophers." "Very true indeed, my dears, but you are blessed with wonderful memories, and your poor cousin has probably none at all. There is a vast deal of difference in memories, as well as in everything else, and therefore you must make allowance for your cousin, and pity her deficiency. And remember that, if you are ever so forward and clever yourselves, you should always be modest, for, much as you know already, there is a great deal more for you to learn." "Yes, I know there is, till I am 17. But I must tell you another thing of Fanny, so odd and so stupid. Do you know, she says she does not want to learn either music or drawing." "To be sure, my dear, that is very stupid indeed, and shows a great want of genius and emulation. But, all things considered, I do not know whether it is not as well that it should be so, for, though you know, owing to me, your papa and mamma are so good as to bring her up with you, it is not at all necessary that she should be as accomplished as you are. On the contrary, it is much more desirable that there should be a difference." Such were the counsels by which Mrs. Norris assisted to form her niece's minds, and it is not very wonderful that, with all their promising talents and early information, they should be entirely deficient in the less common acquirements of self-knowledge, generosity and humility. In everything but disposition they were admirably taught. Sir Thomas did not know what was wanting, because, though a truly anxious father, he was not outwardly affectionate, and the reserve of his manner repressed all the flow of their spirits before him. To the education of her daughters Lady Bertram paid not the smallest attention. She had not time for such cares. She was a woman who spent her days in sitting, nicely dressed, on a sofa, doing some long piece of needlework, of little use and no beauty, thinking more of her pug than her children, but very indulgent to the latter when it did not put herself to inconvenience, guided in everything important by Sir Thomas, and in smaller concerns by her sister. Had she possessed greater leisure for the service of her girls, she would probably have supposed it unnecessary, for they were under the care of a governess, with proper masters, and could want nothing more. As for Fanny's being stupid at learning, she could only say it was very unlucky, but some people were stupid, and Fanny must take more pains. She did not know what else was to be done, and, except her being so dull, she must add she saw no harm in the poor little thing, and always found her very handy and quick in carrying messages, and fetching what she wanted. Fanny, with all her faults of ignorance and timidity, was fixed at Mansfield Park, and learning to transfer in its favor much of her attachment to her former home, grew up there not unhappily among her cousins. There was no positive ill nature in Maria or Julia, and though Fanny was often mortified by their treatment of her, she thought too lowly of her own claims to feel injured by it. From about the time of her entering the family, Lady Bertram, in consequence of a little ill health, and a great deal of indolence, gave up the house in town, which she had been used to occupy every spring, and remained wholly in the country, leaving Sir Thomas to attend his duty in Parliament, with whatever increase or diminution of comfort might arise from her absence. In the country, therefore, the Miss Bertrams continued to exercise their memories, practice their duets, and grow tall and womanly, and their father saw them becoming in person, manner, and accomplishments, everything that could satisfy his anxiety. His eldest son was careless and extravagant, and had already given him much uneasiness, but his other children promised him nothing but good. His daughters, he felt, while they retained the name of Bertram, must be giving it new grace, and in quitting it, he trusted, would extend its respectable alliances, and the character of Edmund, his strong good sense and uprightness of mind, bid most fairly for utility, honor, and happiness to himself and all his connections. He was to be a clergyman. Amid the cares and the complacency which his own children suggested, Sir Thomas did not forget to do what he could for the children of Mrs. Price. He assisted her liberally in the education and disposal of her sons as they became old enough for a determinate pursuit, and Fanny, though almost totally separated from her family, was sensible of the truest satisfaction in hearing of any kindness towards them, or of anything at all promising in their situation or conduct. Once, and once only, in the course of many years, had she the happiness of being with William. Of the rest she saw nothing, nobody seemed to think of her ever going amongst them again, even for a visit, nobody at home seemed to want her, but William determining, soon after her removal, to be a sailor, was invited to spend a week with his sister in Northamptonshire before he went to sea. Their eager affection in meeting, their exquisite delight in being together, their hours of happy mirth, and moments of serious conference, may be imagined, as well as the sanguine views and spirits of the boy even to the last, and the misery of the girl when he left her. Luckily the visit happened in the Christmas holidays, when she could directly look for comfort to her cousin Edmund, and he told her such charming things of what William was to do, and be hereafter, in consequence of his profession, as made her gradually admit that the separation might have some use. Edmund's friendship never failed her, his leaving Eton for Oxford made no change in his kind dispositions, and only afforded more frequent opportunities of proving them. Without any display of doing more than the rest, or any fear of doing too much, he was always true to her interests, and considerate of her feelings, trying to make her good qualities understood, and to conquer the diffidence which prevented their being more apparent, giving her advice, consolation, and encouragement. Kept back as she was by everybody else, his single support could not bring her forward, but his attentions were otherwise of the highest importance in assisting the improvement of her mind, and extending its pleasures. He knew her to be clever, to have a quick apprehension as well as good sense, and a fondness for reading, which, properly directed, must be an education in itself. Miss Lee taught her French, and heard her read the daily portion of history, but he recommended the books which charmed her leisure hours, he encouraged her taste, and corrected her judgment, he made reading useful by talking to her of what she read, and heightened its attraction by judicious praise. In return for such services she loved him better than anybody in the world except William. Her heart was divided between the two. Chapter 3. The first event of any importance in the family was the death of Mr. Norris, which happened when Fanny was about 15, and necessarily introduced alterations and novelties. Mrs. Norris, on quitting the parsonage, removed first to the park, and afterwards to a small house of Sir Thomas's in the village, and consoled herself for the loss of her husband by considering that she could do very well without him, and for her reduction of income by the evident necessity of stricter economy. The living was hereafter for Edmund, and, had his uncle died a few years sooner, it would have been duly given to some friend to hold till he were old enough for orders. But Tom's extravagance had, previous to that event, been so great as to render a different disposal of the next presentation necessary, and the younger brother must help to pay for the pleasures of the elder. There was another family living actually held for Edmund, but though this circumstance had made the arrangement somewhat easier to Sir Thomas's conscience, he could not but feel it to be an act of injustice, and he earnestly tried to impress his eldest son with the same conviction, in the hope of its producing a better effect than anything he had yet been able to say or do. "I blush for you, Tom," said he, in his most dignified manner, "I blush for the expedient which I am driven on, and I trust I may pity your feelings as a brother on the occasion. You have robbed Edmund for 10, 20, 30 years, perhaps for life, of more than half the income which ought to be his. It may hereafter be in my power, or in yours, I hope it will, to procure him better preferment, but it must not be forgotten that no benefit of that sort would have been beyond his natural claims on us, and that nothing can, in fact, be an equivalent for the certain advantage which he is now obliged to forego through the urgency of your debts." Tom listened with some shame and some sorrow, but escaping as quickly as possible, could soon with cheerful selfishness reflect, firstly, that he had not been half so much in debt as some of his friends, secondly, that his father had made a most tiresome piece of work of it, and, thirdly, that the future incumbent, whoever he might be, would, in all probability, die very soon. On Mr. Norris's death the presentation became the right of a Dr. Grant, who came consequently to reside at Mansfield, and on proving to be a hearty man of 45, seemed likely to disappoint Mr. Bertram's calculations. But no, he was a short-necked, apoplectic sort of fellow, and, plied well with good things, would soon pop off. He had a wife about 15 years his junior, but no children, and they entered the neighborhood with the usual fair report of being very respectable, agreeable people. The time was now come when Sir Thomas expected his sister-in-law to claim her share in their niece. The change in Mrs. Norris's situation, and the improvement in Fanny's age, seeming not merely to do away any former objection to their living together, but even to give it the most decided eligibility, and as his own circumstances were rendered less fair than heretofore, by some recent losses on his West India estate, in addition to his eldest son's extravagance, it became not undesirable to himself to be relieved from the expense of her support, and the obligation of her future provision. In the fullness of his belief that such a thing must be, he mentioned its probability to his wife, and the first time of the subject's occurring to her again happening to be when Fanny was present, she calmly observed to her, "So, Fanny, you are going to leave us, and live with my sister. How shall you like it?" Fanny was too much surprised to do more than repeat her aunt's words, "Going to leave you?" "Yes, my dear, why should you be astonished? You have been 5 years with us, and my sister always meant to take you when Mr. Norris died. But you must come up and tack on my patterns all the same." The news was as disagreeable to Fanny as it had been unexpected. She had never received kindness from her aunt Norris, and could not love her. "I shall be very sorry to go away," said she, with a faltering voice. "Yes, I dare say you will, that's natural enough. I suppose you have had as little to vex you since you came into this house as any creature in the world." "I hope I am not ungrateful, aunt," said Fanny modestly. "No, my dear, I hope not. I have always found you a very good girl." "And am I never to live here again?" "Never, my dear, but you are sure of a comfortable home. It can make very little difference to you, whether you are in one house or the other." Fanny left the room with a very sorrowful heart. She could not feel the difference to be so small, she could not think of living with her aunt with anything like satisfaction. As soon as she met with Edmund she told him her distress. "Cousin," said she, "something is going to happen which I do not like at all, and though you have often persuaded me into being reconciled to things that I disliked at first, you will not be able to do it now. I am going to live entirely with my Aunt Norris."
"Indeed?"
"Yes, my Aunt Bertram has just told me so. It is quite settled. I am to leave Mansfield Park, and go to the White House, I suppose, as soon as she is removed there." "Well, Fanny, and if the plan were not unpleasant to you, I should call it an excellent one."
"Oh, cousin. It has everything else in its favor. My aunt is acting like a sensible woman in wishing for you. She is choosing a friend and companion exactly where she ought, and I am glad her love of money does not interfere. You will be what you ought to be to her. I hope it does not distress you very much, Fanny?"
"Indeed it does, I cannot like it. I love this house and everything in it, I shall love nothing there. You know how uncomfortable I feel with her. I can say nothing for her manner to you as a child, but it was the same with us all, or nearly so. She never knew how to be pleasant to children. But you are now of an age to be treated better, I think she is behaving better already,
and when you are her only companion, you must be important to her.
I can never be important to anyone.
What is to prevent you?
Everything. My situation, my foolishness and awkwardness.
As to your foolishness and awkwardness, my dear Fanny, believe me, you never have a shadow of either, but in using the word so improperly. There is no reason in the world why you should not be important where you are known. You have good sense, and a sweet temper, and I am sure you have a grateful heart, that could never receive kindness without wishing to return it. I do not know any better qualifications for a friend and companion.
You are too kind, said Fanny, coloring at such praise. How shall I ever thank you as I ought, for thinking so well of me?
Oh, cousin, if I am to go away, I shall remember your goodness to the last moment of my life.
Why, indeed, Fanny, I should hope to be remembered at such a distance as the White House.
You speak as if you were going 200 miles off instead of only across the park, but you will belong to us almost as much as ever. The two families will be meeting every day in the year. The only difference will be that, living with your aunt, you will necessarily be brought forward as you ought to be. Here there are too many whom you can hide behind, but with her you will be forced to speak for yourself.
Oh, I do not say so. I must say it, and say it with pleasure. Mrs. Norris is much better fitted than my mother for having the charge of you now. She is of a temper to do a great deal for anybody she really interests herself about, and she will force you to do justice to your natural powers.
Fanny sighed, and said, I cannot see things as you do, but I ought to believe you to be right rather than myself, and I am very much obliged to you for trying to reconcile me to what must be. If I could suppose my aunt really to care for me, it would be delightful to feel myself of consequence to anybody. Here, I know, I am of none, and yet I love the place so well.
The place, Fanny, is what you will not quit, though you quit the house. You will have as free a command of the park and gardens as ever. Even your constant little heart need not take fright at such a nominal change. You will have the same walks to frequent, the same library to choose from, the same people to look at, the same horse to ride.
Very true.
Yes, dear old gray pony.
Ah, cousin, when I remember how much I used to dread riding, what terrors it gave me to hear it talked of as likely to do me good, oh! How I have trembled at my uncle's opening his lips if horses were talked of, and then think of the kind pains you took to reason and persuade me out of my fears, and convince me that I should like it after a little while, and feel how right you proved to be, I am inclined to hope you may always prophesy as well. And I am quite convinced that your being with Mrs. Norris will be as good for your mind as riding has been for your health, and as much for your ultimate happiness too. So ended their discourse, which, for any very appropriate service it could render Fanny, might as well have been spared, for Mrs. Norris had not the smallest intention of taking her. It had never occurred to her, on the present occasion, but as a thing to be carefully avoided. To prevent its being expected, she had fixed on the smallest habitation which could rank as genteel among the buildings of Mansfield Parish, the White House being only just large enough to receive herself and her servants, and allow a spare room for a friend, of which she made a very particular point. The spare rooms at the parsonage had never been wanted, but the absolute necessity of a spare room for a friend was now never forgotten. Not all her precautions, however, could save her from being suspected of something better, or, perhaps, her very display of the importance of a spare room might have misled Sir Thomas to suppose it really intended for Fanny. Lady Bertram soon brought the matter to a certainty by carelessly observing to Mrs. Norris, I think, sister, we need not keep Miss Lee any longer, when Fanny goes to live with you. Mrs. Norris almost started. Live with me, dear Lady Bertram. What do you mean? Is she not to live with you? I thought you had settled it with Sir Thomas.
Me? Never. I never spoke a syllable about it to Sir Thomas, nor he to me.
Fanny live with me. The last thing in the world for me to think of, or for anybody to wish that really knows us both. Good heaven! What could I do with Fanny?
Me? A poor, helpless, forlorn widow, unfit for anything, my spirits quite broke down, what could I do with a girl at her time of life? A girl of 15. The very age of all others to need most attention and care, and put the cheerfulest spirits to the test. Sure Sir Thomas could not seriously expect such a thing. Sir Thomas is too much my friend. Nobody that wishes me well, I am sure, would propose it. How came Sir Thomas to speak to you about it?
Indeed, I do not know. I suppose he thought it best.
But what did he say?
He could not say he wished me to take Fanny. I'm sure in his heart he could not wish me to do it.
No, he only said he thought it very likely,
and I thought so too. We both thought it would be a comfort to you. But if you do not like it, there is no more to be said. She is no encumbrance here.
Dear sister, if you consider my unhappy state, how can she be any comfort to me? Here am I, a poor desolate widow, deprived of the best of husbands, my health gone in attending and nursing him, my spirits still worse, all my peace in this world destroyed, with hardly enough to support me in the rank of a gentlewoman, and enable me to live so as not to disgrace the memory of the dear departed. What possible comfort could I have in taking such a charge upon me as Fanny? If I could wish it for my own sake, I would not do so unjust a thing by the poor girl. She is in good hands, and sure of doing well. I must struggle through my sorrows and difficulties as I can.
Then you will not mind living by yourself quite alone?
Lady Bertram, I do not complain. I know I cannot live as I have done, but I must retrench where I can, and learn to be a better manager. I have been a liberal housekeeper enough, but I shall not be ashamed to practice economy now. My situation is as much altered as my income. A great many things were due from poor Mr. Norris, as clergyman of the parish, that cannot be expected from me. It is unknown how much was consumed in our kitchen by odd comers and goers. At the White House, matters must be better looked after. I must live within my income, or I shall be miserable, and I own it would give me great satisfaction to be able to do rather more, to lay by a little at the end of the year.
I dare say you will. You always do, don't you?
My object, Lady Bertram, is to be of use to those that come after me. It is for your children's good that I wish to be richer. I have nobody else to care for, but I should be very glad to think I could leave a little trifle among them worth their having.
You are very good, but do not trouble yourself about them. They are sure of being well provided for. Sir Thomas will take care of that.
Why, you know, Sir Thomas's means will be rather straitened if the antique estate is to make such poor returns.
Oh, that will soon be settled. Sir Thomas has been writing about it, I know.
Well, Lady Bertram, said Mrs. Norris, moving to go, I can only say that my sole desire is to be of use to your family, and so, if Sir Thomas should ever speak again about my taking Fanny, you will be able to say that my health and spirits put it quite out of the question. Besides that, I really should not have a bed to give her, for I must keep a spare room for a friend.
Lady Bertram repeated enough of this conversation to her husband to convince him how much he had mistaken his sister-in-law's views, and she was from that moment perfectly safe from all expectation, or the slightest allusion to it from him. He could not but wonder at her refusing to do anything for a niece whom she had been so forward to adopt, but, as she took early care to make him, as well as Lady Bertram, understand that whatever she possessed was designed for their family, he soon grew reconciled to a distinction which, at the same time that it was advantageous and complimentary to them, would enable him better to provide for Fanny himself. Fanny soon learned how unnecessary had been her fears of a removal, and her spontaneous, untaught felicity on the discovery, conveyed some consolation to Edmund for his disappointment in what he had expected to be so essentially serviceable to her. Mrs. Norris took possession of the White House, the Grants arrived at the parsonage, and these events over, everything at Mansfield went on for some time as usual. The Grants, showing a disposition to be friendly and sociable, gave great satisfaction in the main among their new acquaintance. They had their faults, and Mrs. Norris soon found them out. The doctor was very fond of eating, and would have a good dinner every day, and Mrs. Grant, instead of contriving to gratify him at little expense, gave her cook as high wages as they did at Mansfield Park, and was scarcely ever seen in her offices. Mrs. Norris could not speak with any temper of such grievances, nor of the quantity of butter and eggs that were regularly consumed in the house. Nobody loved plenty and hospitality more than herself, nobody more hated pitiful doings. The parsonage, she believed, had never been wanting in comforts of any sort, had never borne a bad character in her time, but this was a way of going on that she could not understand. A fine lady in a country parsonage was quite out of place. Her storeroom, she thought, might have been good enough for Mrs. Grant to go into. Inquire where she would, she could not find out that Mrs. Grant had ever had more than £5,000. Lady Bertram listened without much interest to this sort of invective. She could not enter into the wrongs of an economist, but she felt all the injuries of beauty in Mrs. Grant's being so well settled in life without being handsome, and expressed her astonishment on that point almost as often, though not so diffusely, as Mrs. Norris discussed the other. These opinions had been hardly canvassed a year before another event arose of such importance in the family, as might fairly claim some place in the thoughts and conversation of the ladies. Sir Thomas found it expedient to go to Antigua himself, for the better arrangement of his affairs, and he took his eldest son with him, in the hope of detaching him from some bad connections at home. They left England with the probability of being nearly a 12-month absent. The necessity of the measure in a pecuniary light, and the hope of its utility to his son, reconciled Sir Thomas to the effort of quitting the rest of his family, and of leaving his daughters to the direction of others at their present most interesting time of life. He could not think Lady Bertram quite equal to supply his place with them, or rather, to perform what should have been her own, but, in Mrs. Norris's watchful attention, and in Edmund's judgment, he had sufficient confidence to make him go without fears for their conduct. Lady Bertram did not at all like to have her husband leave her, but she was not disturbed by any alarm for his safety, or solicitude for his comfort, being one of those persons who think nothing can be dangerous, or difficult, or fatiguing to anybody but themselves. The Miss Bertrams were much to be pitied on the occasion, not for their sorrow, but for their want of it. Their father was no object of love to them, he had never seemed the friend of their pleasures, and his absence was unhappily most welcome. They were relieved by it from all restraint, and without aiming at one gratification that would probably have been forbidden by Sir Thomas, they felt themselves immediately at their own disposal, and to have every indulgence within their reach. Fanny's relief, and her consciousness of it, were quite equal to her cousin's, but a more tender nature suggested that her feelings were ungrateful, and she really grieved because she could not grieve. Sir Thomas, who had done so much for her and her brothers, and who was gone perhaps never to return. That she should see him go without a tear. It was a shameful insensibility. He had said to her, moreover, on the very last morning, that he hoped she might see William again in the course of the ensuing winter, and had charged her to write and invite him to Mansfield as soon as the squadron to which he belonged should be known to be in England. This was so thoughtful and kind. And would he only have smiled upon her, and called her my dear Fanny, while he said it, every former frown or cold address might have been forgotten. But he had ended his speech in the way to sink her in sad mortification, by adding, if William does come to Mansfield, I hope you may be able to convince him that the many years which have passed since you parted have not been spent on your side entirely without improvement, though, I fear, he must find his sister at 16 in some respects too much like his sister at 10. She cried bitterly over this reflection when her uncle was gone, and her cousins, on seeing her with red eyes, set her down as a hypocrite. Chapter 4. Tom Bertram had of late spent so little of his time at home that he could be only nominally missed, and Lady Bertram was soon astonished to find how very well they did even without his father, how well Edmund could supply his place in carving, talking to the steward, writing to the attorney, settling with the servants, and equally saving her from all possible fatigue or exertion in every particular but that of directing her letters. The earliest intelligence of the traveller's safe arrival at Antigua, after a favourable voyage, was received, though not before Mrs. Norris had been indulging in very dreadful fears, and trying to make Edmund participate them whenever she could get him alone, and as she depended on being the first person made acquainted with any fatal catastrophe, she had already arranged the manner of breaking it to all the others, when Sir Thomas's assurances of their both being alive and well made it necessary to lay by her agitation and affectionate preparatory speeches for a while. The winter came and passed without their being called for, the accounts continued perfectly good, and Mrs. Norris, in promoting gaieties for her nieces, assisting their toilets, displaying their accomplishments, and looking about for their future husbands, had so much to do as, in addition to all her own household cares, some interference in those of her sister, and Mrs. Grant's wasteful doings to overlook, left her very little occasion to be occupied in fears for the absent. The Miss Bertrams were now fully established among the belles of the neighborhood, and as they joined to beauty and brilliant acquirements a manner naturally easy, and carefully formed to general civility and obligingness, they possessed its favor as well as its admiration. Their vanity was in such good order that they seemed to be quite free from it, and gave themselves no airs, while the praises attending such behavior, secured and brought round by their aunt, served to strengthen them in believing they had no faults. Lady Bertram did not go into public with her daughters. She was too indolent even to accept a mother's gratification in witnessing their success and enjoyment at the expense of any personal trouble, and the charge was made over to her sister, who desired nothing better than a post of such honorable representation, and very thoroughly relished the means it afforded her of mixing in society without having horses to hire. Fanny had no share in the festivities of the season, but she enjoyed being avowedly useful as her aunt's companion when they called away the rest of the family, and, as Miss Lee had left Mansfield, she naturally became everything to Lady Bertram during the night of a ball or a party. She talked to her, listened to her, read to her, and the tranquility of such evenings, Her perfect security in such a tête-à-tête from any sound of unkindness was unspeakably welcome to a mind which had seldom known a pause in its alarms or embarrassments. As to her cousin's gaieties, she loved to hear an account of them, especially of the balls, and whom Edmund had danced with, but thought too lowly of her own situation to imagine she should ever be admitted to the same, and listened, therefore, without an idea of any nearer concern in them. Upon the whole, it was a comfortable winter to her, for though it brought no William to England, the never-failing hope of his arrival was worth much. The ensuing spring deprived her of her valued friend, the old grey pony, and for some time she was in danger of feeling the loss in her health as well as in her affections, for in spite of the acknowledged importance of her riding on horseback, no measures were taken for mounting her again, because, as it was observed by her aunts, she might ride one of her cousin's horses at any time when they did not want them, and as the Miss Bertrams regularly wanted their horses every fine day, and had no idea of carrying their obliging manners to the sacrifice of any real pleasure, that time, of course, never came. They took their cheerful rides in the fine mornings of April and May, and Fanny either sat at home the whole day with one aunt, or walked beyond her strength at the instigation of the other, Lady Bertram holding exercise to be as unnecessary for everybody as it was unpleasant to herself, and Mrs. Norris, who was walking all day, thinking everybody ought to walk as much. Edmund was absent at this time, or the evil would have been earlier remedied. When he returned, to understand how Fanny was situated, and perceived its ill effects, there seemed with him but one thing to be done, and that Fanny must have a horse was the resolute declaration with which he opposed whatever could be urged by the supineness of his mother, or the economy of his aunt, to make it appear unimportant. Mrs. Norris could not help thinking that some steady old thing might be found among the numbers belonging to the park that would do vastly well, or that one might be borrowed of the steward, or that perhaps Dr. Grant might now and then lend them the pony he sent to the post. She could not but consider it as absolutely unnecessary, and even improper, that Fanny should have a regular lady's horse of her own, in the style of her cousin's. She was sure Sir Thomas had never intended it, and she must say that, to be making such a purchase in his absence, and adding to the great expenses of his stable, at a time when a large part of his income was unsettled, seemed to her very unjustifiable. "Fanny must have a horse," was Edmund's only reply. Mrs. Norris could not see it in the same light. Lady Bertram did. She entirely agreed with her son as to the necessity of it, and as to its being considered necessary by his father, she only pleaded against there being any hurry. She only wanted him to wait till Sir Thomas's return, and then Sir Thomas might settle it all himself. He would be at home in September, and where would be the harm of only waiting till September? Though Edmund was much more displeased with his aunt than with his mother, as evincing least regard for her niece, he could not help paying more attention to what she said, and at length determined on a method of proceeding which would obviate the risk of his father's thinking he had done too much, and at the same time procure for Fanny the immediate means of exercise, which he could not bear she should be without. He had three horses of his own, but not one that would carry a woman. Two of them were hunters, the third, a useful road horse. This third he resolved to exchange for one that his cousin might ride. He knew where such a one was to be met with, and having once made up his mind, the whole business was soon completed. The new mare proved a treasure. With a very little trouble she became exactly calculated for the purpose, and Fanny was then put in almost full possession of her. She had not supposed before that anything could ever suit her like the old grey pony, but her delight in Edmund's mare was far beyond any former pleasure of the sort, and the addition it was ever receiving in the consideration of that kindness from which her pleasure sprung, was beyond all her words to express. She regarded her cousin as an example of everything good and great, as possessing worth which no one but herself could ever appreciate, and as entitled to such gratitude from her as no feelings could be strong enough to pay. Her sentiments towards him were compounded of all that was respectful, grateful, confiding, and tender. As the horse continued in name, as well as fact, the property of Edmund, Mrs. Norris could tolerate its being for Fanny's use, and had Lady Bertram ever thought about her own objection again, he might have been excused in her eyes for not waiting till Sir Thomas's return in September, for when September came Sir Thomas was still abroad, and without any near prospect of finishing his business. Unfavorable circumstances had suddenly arisen at a moment when he was beginning to turn all his thoughts towards England, and the very great uncertainty in which everything was then involved determined him on sending home his son, and waiting the final arrangement by himself. Tom arrived safely, bringing an excellent account of his father's health, but to very little purpose, as far as Mrs. Norris was concerned. Sir Thomas's sending away his son seemed to her so like a parent's care, under the influence of a foreboding of evil to himself, that she could not help feeling dreadful presentiments, and as the long evenings of autumn came on, was so terribly haunted by these ideas, in the sad solitariness of her cottage, as to be obliged to take daily refuge in the dining room of the park. The return of winter engagements, however, was not without its effect, and in the course of their progress, her mind became so pleasantly occupied in superintending the fortunes of her eldest niece, as tolerably to quiet her nerves. If poor Sir Thomas were fated never to return, it would be peculiarly consoling to see their dear Maria well married, she very often thought, always when they were in the company of men of fortune, and particularly on the introduction of a young man who had recently succeeded to one of the largest estates and finest places in the country. Mr. Rushworth was from the first struck with the beauty of Miss Bertram, and, being inclined to marry, soon fancied himself in love. He was a heavy young man, with not more than common sense, but as there was nothing disagreeable in his figure or address, the young lady was well pleased with her conquest. Being now in her 21st year, Maria Bertram was beginning to think matrimony a duty, and as a marriage with Mr. Rushworth would give her the enjoyment of a larger income than her father's, as well as ensure her the house in town, which was now a prime object, it became, by the same rule of moral obligation, her evident duty to marry Mr. Rushworth if she could. Mrs. Norris was most zealous in promoting the match, by every suggestion and contrivance likely to enhance its desirableness to either party, and, among other means, by seeking an intimacy with the gentleman's mother, who at present lived with him, and to whom she even forced Lady Bertram to go through 10 miles of indifferent road to pay a morning visit. It was not long before a good understanding took place between this lady and herself. Mrs. Rushworth acknowledged herself very desirous that her son should marry, and declared that of all the young ladies she had ever seen, Miss Bertram seemed, by her amiable qualities and accomplishments, the best adapted to make him happy. Mrs. Norris accepted the compliment, and admired the nice discernment of character which could so well distinguish merit. Maria was indeed the pride and delight of them all, perfectly faultless and angel, and, of course, so surrounded by admirers, must be difficult in her choice, but yet, as far as Mrs. Norris could allow herself to decide on so short an acquaintance, Mr. Rushworth appeared precisely the young man to deserve and attach her. After dancing with each other at a proper number of balls, the young people justified these opinions, and an engagement, with a due reference to the absent Sir Thomas, was entered into, much to the satisfaction of their respective families, and of the general lookers-on of the neighborhood, who had, for many weeks past, felt the expediency of Mr. Rushworth's marrying Miss Bertram. It was some months before Sir Thomas's consent could be received, but, in the meanwhile, as no one felt a doubt of his most cordial pleasure in the connection, the intercourse of the two families was carried on without restraint, and no other attempt made at secrecy than Mrs. Norris's talking of it everywhere as a matter not to be talked of at present. Edmund was the only one of the family who could see a fault in the business, but no representation of his aunt's could induce him to find Mr. Rushworth a desirable companion. He could allow his sister to be the best judge of her own happiness, but he was not pleased that her happiness should center in a large income, nor could he refrain from often saying to himself, in Mr. Rushworth's company if this man had not 12,000 a year, he would be a very stupid fellow. Sir Thomas, however, was truly happy in the prospect of an alliance so unquestionably advantageous, and of which he heard nothing but the perfectly good and agreeable. It was a connection exactly of the right sort in the same county, and the same interest and his most hearty concurrence was conveyed as soon as possible. He only conditioned that the marriage should not take place before his return, which he was again looking eagerly forward to. He wrote in April, and had strong hopes of settling everything to his entire satisfaction, and leaving Antigua before the end of the summer. Such was the state of affairs in the month of July, and Fanny had just reached her 18th year, when the society of the village received an addition in the brother and sister of Mrs. Grant, a Mr. and Miss Crawford, the children of her mother by a second marriage. They were young people of fortune. The son had a good estate in Norfolk, the daughter £20,000. As children, their sister had been always very fond of them, but, as their own marriage had been soon followed by the death of their common parent, which left them to the care of a brother of their father, of whom Mrs. Grant knew nothing, she had scarcely seen them since. In their uncle's house they had found a kind home. Admiral and Mrs. Crawford, though agreeing in nothing else, were united in affection for these children, or, at least, were no farther adverse in their feelings than that each had their favorite, to whom they showed the greatest fondness of the two. The admiral delighted in the boy, Mrs. Crawford doted on the girl, and it was the lady's death which now obliged her protégé, after some months' further trial at her uncle's house, to find another home. Admiral Crawford was a man of vicious conduct, who chose, instead of retaining his niece, to bring his mistress under his own roof, and to this Mrs. Grant was indebted for her sister's proposal of coming to her, a measure quite as welcome on one side as it could be expedient on the other, for Mrs. Grant, having by this time run through the usual resources of ladies residing in the country without a family of children, having more than filled her favorite sitting room with pretty furniture, and made a choice collection of plants and poultry, was very much in want of some variety at home. The arrival, therefore, of a sister whom she had always loved, and now hoped to retain with her as long as she remained single, was highly agreeable, and her chief anxiety was lest Mansfield should not satisfy the habits of a young woman who had been mostly used to London. Miss Crawford was not entirely free from similar apprehensions, though they arose principally from doubts of her sister's style of living and tone of society, and it was not till after she had tried in vain to persuade her brother to settle with her at his own country house, that she could resolve to hazard herself among her other relations. To anything like a permanence of abode, or limitation of society, Henry Crawford had, unluckily, a great dislike. He could not accommodate his sister in an article of such importance, but he escorted her, with the utmost kindness, into Northamptonshire, and is readily engaged to fetch her away again, at half an hour's notice, whenever she were weary of the place. The meeting was very satisfactory on each side. Miss Crawford found a sister without preciseness or rusticity, a sister's husband who looked the gentleman, and a house commodious and well fitted up, and Mrs. Grant received in those whom she hoped to love better than ever a young man and woman of very prepossessing appearance. Mary Crawford was remarkably pretty. Henry, though not handsome, had air and countenance, the manners of both were lively and pleasant, and Mrs. Grant immediately gave them credit for everything else. She was delighted with each, but Mary was her dearest object, and having never been able to glory in beauty of her own, she thoroughly enjoyed the power of being proud of her sisters. She had not waited her arrival to look out for a suitable match for her. She had fixed on Tom Bertram, the eldest son of a baronet, was not too good for a girl of £20,000, with all the elegance and accomplishments which Mrs. Grant foresaw in her, and being a warm-hearted, unreserved woman, Mary had not been 3 hours in the house before she told her what she had planned. Miss Crawford was glad to find a family of such consequence so very near them, and not at all displeased either at her sister's early care, or the choice it had fallen on. Matrimony was her object, provided she could marry well, and having seen Mr. Bertram in town, she knew that objection could no more be made to his person than to his situation in life. While she treated it as a joke, therefore, she did not forget to think of it seriously. The scheme was soon repeated to Henry. "And now," added Mrs. Grant, "I have thought of something to make it complete. I should dearly love to settle you both in this country, and therefore, Henry, you shall marry the youngest Miss Bertram, a nice, handsome, good-humored, accomplished girl, who will make you very happy." Henry Bowden thanked her. "My dear sister," said Mary, "if you can persuade him into anything of the sort, it will be a fresh matter of delight to me to find myself allied to anybody so clever, and I shall only regret that you have not half a dozen daughters to dispose of. If you can persuade Henry to marry, you must have the address of a French woman. All that English abilities can do has been tried already. I have 3 very particular friends who have been all dying for him in their turn, and the pains which they, their mothers, very clever women, as well as my dear aunt and myself, have taken to reason, coax, or trick him into marrying, is inconceivable. He is the most horrible flirt that can be imagined. If your Miss Bertrams do not like to have their hearts broke, let them avoid Henry." "My dear brother, I will not believe this of you." "No, I am sure you are too good. You will be kinder than Mary. You will allow for the doubts of youth and inexperience. I am of a cautious temper, and unwilling to risk my happiness in a hurry. Nobody can think more highly of the matrimonial state than myself. I consider the blessing of a wife as most justly described in those discreet lines of the poet, Heaven's last best gift. There, Mrs. Grant, you see how he dwells on one word, and only look at his smile. I assure you he is very detestable. The Admiral's lessons have quite spoiled him." "I pay very little regard," said Mrs. Grant, "to what any young person says on the subject of marriage. If they profess a disinclination for it, I only set it down that they have not yet seen the right person." Dr. Grant laughingly congratulated Miss Crawford on feeling no disinclination to the state herself. "Oh yes. I am not at all ashamed of it. I would have everybody marry if they can do it properly. I do not like to have people throw themselves away, but everybody should marry as soon as they can do it to advantage." Chapter 5. The young people were pleased with each other from the first. On each side there was much to attract, and their acquaintance soon promised as early an intimacy as good manners would warrant. Miss Crawford's beauty did her no disservice with the Miss Bertrams. They were too handsome themselves to dislike any woman for being so too, and were almost as much charmed as their brothers with her lively dark eye, clear brown complexion, and general prettiness. Had she been tall, full-formed, and fair, it might have been more of a trial, but as it was, there could be no comparison, and she was most allowably a sweet, pretty girl, while they were the finest young women in the country. Her brother was not handsome, no, when they first saw him he was absolutely plain, black and plain, but still he was the gentleman, with a pleasing address. The second meeting proved him not so very plain, he was plain, to be sure, but then he had so much countenance, and his teeth were so good, and he was so well made, that one soon forgot he was plain, and after a third interview, after dining in company with him at the parsonage, he was no longer allowed to be called so by anybody. He was, in fact, the most agreeable young man the sisters had ever known, and they were equally delighted with him. Miss Bertram's engagement made him in equity the property of Julia, of which Julia was fully aware, and before he had been at Mansfield a week, she was quite ready to be fallen in love with. Maria's notions on the subject were more confused and indistinct. She did not want to see or understand. There could be no harm in her liking an agreeable man. Everybody knew her situation. Mr. Crawford must take care of himself. Mr. Crawford did not mean to be in any danger. The Miss Bertrams were worth pleasing, and were ready to be pleased, and he began with no object but of making them like him. He did not want them to die of love, but with sense and temper which ought to have made him judge and feel better, he allowed himself great latitude on such points. "I like your Miss Bertrams exceedingly, sister," said he, as he returned from attending them to their carriage after the said dinner visit. "They are very elegant, agreeable girls." "So they are indeed, and I am delighted to hear you say it. But you like Julia best?"
"Oh yes. I like Julia best."
"But do you really? For Miss Bertram is in general thought the handsomest."
"So I should suppose. She has the advantage in every feature, and I prefer her countenance, but I like Julia best. Miss Bertram is certainly the handsomest, and I have found her the most agreeable, but I shall always like Julia best, because you order me. I shall not talk to you, Henry, but I know you will like her best at last. Do not I tell you that I like her best at first? And besides, Miss Bertram is engaged. Remember that, my dear brother. Her choice is made."
"Yes, and I like her the better for it. An engaged woman is always more agreeable than a disengaged. She is satisfied with herself. Her cares are over, and she feels that she may exert all her powers of pleasing without suspicion. All is safe with a lady engaged, no harm can be done."
"Why, as to that, Mr. Rushworth is a very good sort of young man, and it is a great match for her."
"But Miss Bertram does not care three straws for him." "That is your opinion of your intimate friend. I do not subscribe to it. I'm sure Miss Bertram is very much attached to Mr. Rushworth. I could see it in her eyes, when he was mentioned. I think too well of Miss Bertram to suppose she would ever give her hand without her heart. Mary, how shall we manage him?"
"We must leave him to himself, I believe. Talking does no good. He will be taken in at last."
"But I would not have him taken in, I would not have him duped, I would have it all fair and honorable."
"Oh dear. Let him stand his chance and be taken in. It will do just as well. Everybody is taken in at some period or other."
"Not always in marriage, dear Mary."
"In marriage especially. With all due respect to such of the present company as chance to be married, my dear Mrs. Grant, there is not one in a hundred of either sex who is not taken in when they marry. Look where I will, I see that it is so, and I feel that it must be so, when I consider that it is, of all transactions, the one in which people expect most from others, and are least honest themselves."
"Ah. You have been in a bad school for matrimony, in Hill Street."
"My poor aunt had certainly little cause to love the state, but, however, speaking from my own observation, it is a maneuvering business. I know so many who have married in the full expectation and confidence of some one particular advantage in the connection, or accomplishment, or good quality in the person, who have found themselves entirely deceived, and been obliged to put up with exactly the reverse. What is this but a take-in?
My dear child, there must be a little imagination here. I beg your pardon, but I cannot quite believe you. Depend upon it, you see but half. You see the evil, but you do not see the consolation. There will be little rubs and disappointments everywhere, and we are all apt to expect too much. But then, if one scheme of happiness fails, human nature turns to another. If the first calculation is wrong, we make a second better. We find comfort somewhere in those evil-minded observers, dearest Mary, who make much of a little, are more taken in and deceived than the parties themselves.
Well done, sister. I honor your esprit du corps. When I am a wife, I mean to be just as staunch myself, and I wish my friends in general would be so too. It would save me many a heartache.
You are as bad as your brother, Mary, but we will cure you both. Mansfield shall cure you both, and without any taking in. Stay with us, and we will cure you.
The Crawfords, without wanting to be cured, were very willing to stay. Mary was satisfied with the parsonage as a present home, and Henry equally ready to lengthen his visit. He had come, intending to spend only a few days with them, but Mansfield promised well, and there was nothing to call him elsewhere. It delighted Mrs. Grant to keep them both with her, and Dr. Grant was exceedingly well contented to have it so. A talking pretty young woman like Miss Crawford is always pleasant society to an indolent, stay-at-home man, and Mr. Crawford's being his guest was an excuse for drinking claret every day. The Miss Bertram's admiration of Mr. Crawford was more rapturous than anything which Miss Crawford's habits made her likely to feel. She acknowledged, however, that the Mr. Bertrams were very fine young men, that two such young men were not often seen together even in London, and that their manners, particularly those of the eldest, were very good. He had been much in London, and had more liveliness and gallantry than Edmund, and must, therefore, be preferred, and, indeed, his being the eldest was another strong claim. She had felt an early presentiment that she should like the eldest best. She knew it was her way. Tom Bertram must have been thought pleasant, indeed, at any rate, he was the sort of young man to be generally liked. His agreeableness was of the kind to be oftener found agreeable than some endowments of a higher stamp, for he had easy manners, excellent spirits, a large acquaintance, and a great deal to say, and the reversion of Mansfield Park, and a baronetcy, did no harm to all this. Miss Crawford soon felt that he and his situation might do. She looked about her with due consideration, and found almost everything in his favor: a park, a real park, 5 miles round, a spacious modern-built house, so well placed and well screened as to deserve to be in any collection of engravings of gentlemen's seats in the kingdom, and wanting only to be completely new furnished pleasant sisters, a quiet mother, and an agreeable man himself with the advantage of being tied up from much gaming at present by a promise to his father, and of being Sir Thomas hereafter. It might do very well, she believed she should accept him, and she began accordingly to interest herself a little about the horse which he had to run at the B races. These races were to call him away not long after their acquaintance began, and as it appeared that the family did not, from his usual goings-on, expect him back again for many weeks, it would bring his passion to an early proof. Much was said on his side to induce her to attend the races, and schemes were made for a large party to them, with all the eagerness of inclination, but it would only do to be talked of. And Fanny, what was she doing and thinking all this while? And what was her opinion of the newcomers? Few young ladies of 18 could be less called on to speak their opinion than Fanny. In a quiet way, very little attended to, she paid her tribute of admiration to Miss Crawford's beauty, but as she still continued to think Mr. Crawford very plain, in spite of her two cousins having repeatedly proved the contrary, she never mentioned him. The notice, which she excited herself, was to this effect: "I begin now to understand you all, except Miss Price," said Miss Crawford, as she was walking with the Mr. Bertrams. "Pray, is she out, or is she not? I am puzzled. She dined at the parsonage, with the rest of you, which seemed like being out, and yet she says so little, that I can hardly suppose she is." Edmund, to whom this was chiefly addressed, replied, "I believe I know what you mean, but I will not undertake to answer the question. My cousin is grown up. She has the age and sense of a woman, but the outs and not outs are beyond me. And yet, in general, nothing can be more easily ascertained. The distinction is so broad. Manners as well as appearance are, generally speaking, so totally different. Till now, I could not have supposed it possible to be mistaken as to a girl's being out or not. A girl not out has always the same sort of dress, a close bonnet, for instance, looks very demure, and never says a word. You may smile, but it is so, I assure you, and except that it is sometimes carried a little too far, it is all very proper. Girls should be quiet and modest. The most objectionable part is, that the alteration of manners on being introduced into company is frequently too sudden.
They sometimes pass in such very little time from reserve to quite the opposite to confidence. That is the faulty part of the present system. One does not like to see a girl of 18 or 19 so immediately up to everything, and perhaps when one has seen her hardly able to speak the year before. Mr. Bertram, I dare say you have sometimes met with such changes.
I believe I have, but this is hardly fair. I see what you are at. You are quizzing me and Miss Anderson.
No, indeed. Miss Anderson. I do not know who or what you mean. I am quite in the dark. But I will quiz you with a great deal of pleasure, if you will tell me what about.
Ah. You carry it off very well, but I cannot be quite so far imposed on. You must have had Miss Anderson in your eye, in describing an altered young lady. You paint too accurately for mistake.
It was exactly so. The Andersons of Baker Street. We were speaking of them the other day, you know.
Edmund, you have heard me mention Charles Anderson. The circumstance was precisely as this lady has represented it. When Anderson first introduced me to his family, about 2 years ago, his sister was not out, and I could not get her to speak to me. I sat there an hour one morning waiting for Anderson, with only her and a little girl or two in the room, the governess being sick or run away, and the mother in and out every moment with letters of business, and I could hardly get a word or a look from the young lady. Nothing like a civil answer. She screwed up her mouth, and turned from me with such an air. I did not see her again for a 12-month. She was then out. I met her at Mrs. Holford's, and did not recollect her. She came up to me, claimed me as an acquaintance, stared me out of countenance, and talked and laughed till I did not know which way to look. I felt that I must be the jest of the room at the time, and Miss Crawford, it is plain, has heard the story. And a very pretty story it is, and with more truth in it, I dare say, than does credit to Miss Anderson. It is too common a fault. Mothers certainly have not yet got quite the right way of managing their daughters. I do not know where the error lies. I do not pretend to set people right, but I do see that they are often wrong. Those who are showing the world what female manners should be, said Mr. Bertram gallantly, are doing a great deal to set them right.
The error is plain enough, said the less courteous Edmund. Such girls are ill brought up. They are given wrong notions from the beginning. They are always acting upon motives of vanity, and there is no more real modesty in their behavior before they appear in public than afterwards.
I do not know, replied Miss Crawford hesitatingly.
Yes, I cannot agree with you there. It is certainly the modestest part of the business. It is much worse to have girls not outgive themselves the same airs and take the same liberties as if they were, which I have seen done. That is worse than anything quite disgusting.
Yes, that is very inconvenient indeed, said Mr. Bertram. It leads one astray, one does not know what to do. The close bonnet and demure air you describe so well, and nothing was ever juster, tell one what is expected, but I got into a dreadful scrape last year from the want of them. I went down to Ramsgate for a week with a friend last September, just after my return from the West Indies. My friend Snade, you have heard me speak of Snade, Edmund his father, and mother, and sisters, were there, all new to me. When we reached Albion Place they were out, we went after them, and found them on the pier, Mrs. and the two Miss Snades, with others of their acquaintance. I made my bow and form, and as Mrs. Snade was surrounded by men, attached myself to one of her daughters, walked by her side all the way home, and made myself as agreeable as I could, the young lady perfectly easy in her manners, and as ready to talk as to listen. I had not a suspicion that I could be doing anything wrong. They looked just the same, both well-dressed, with veils and parasols like other girls, but I afterwards found that I had been giving all my attention to the youngest, who was not out, and had most excessively offended the eldest. Miss Augusta ought not to have been noticed for the next 6 months, and Miss Snade, I believe, has never forgiven me. That was bad indeed. Poor Miss Snade. Though I have no younger sister, I feel for her. To be neglected before one's time must be very vexatious, but it was entirely the mother's fault. Miss Augusta should have been with her governess. Such half and half doings never prosper. But now I must be satisfied about Miss Price. Does she go to balls? Does she dine out everywhere, as well as at my sister's?
No, replied Edmund, I do not think she has ever been to a ball. My mother seldom goes into company herself, and dines nowhere but with Mrs. Grant, and Fanny stays at home with her.
Oh. Then the point is clear. Miss Price is not out.
Chapter 6.
Mr. Bertram set off for, and Miss Crawford was prepared to find a great chasm in their society, and to miss him decidedly in the meetings which were now becoming almost daily between the families, and on their all dining together at the park soon after his going,
She retook her chosen place near the bottom of the table, fully expecting to feel a most melancholy difference in the change of masters. It would be a very flat business, she was sure. In comparison with his brother, Edmund would have nothing to say. The soup would be sent round in a most spiritless manner, wine drank without any smiles or agreeable trifling, and the venison cut up without supplying one pleasant anecdote of any former haunch, or a single entertaining story, about my friend such a one. She must try to find amusement in what was passing at the upper end of the table, and in observing Mr. Rushworth, who was now making his appearance at Mansfield for the first time since the Crawfords' arrival. He had been visiting a friend in the neighboring county, and that friend having recently had his grounds laid out by an improver, Mr. Rushworth was returned with his head full of the subject, and very eager to be improving his own place in the same way, and though not saying much to the purpose, could talk of nothing else. The subject had been already handled in the drawing room, it was revived in the dining parlor. Miss Bertram's attention and opinion was evidently his chief aim, and though her deportment showed rather conscious superiority than any solicitude to oblige him, the mention of Southerton Court, and the ideas attached to it, gave her a feeling of complacency, which prevented her from being very ungracious. "I wish you could see Compton," said he, "it is the most complete thing. I never saw a place so altered in my life. I told Smith I did not know where I was. The approach now is one of the finest things in the country. You see the house in the most surprising manner. I declare, when I got back to Southerton yesterday, it looked like a prison, quite a dismal old prison."
"Oh, for shame!" cried Mrs. Norris. "A prison indeed? Southerton Court is the noblest old place in the world.
It wants improvement, ma'am, beyond anything. I never saw a place that wanted so much improvement in my life, and it is so forlorn that I do not know what can be done with it."
"No wonder that Mr. Rushworth should think so at present," said Mrs. Grant to Mrs. Norris, with a smile, "but depend upon it, Southerton will have every improvement in time which his heart can desire."
"I must try to do something with it," said Mr. Rushworth, "but I do not know what. I hope I shall have some good friend to help me."
"Your best friend upon such an occasion," said Miss Bertram calmly, "would be Mr. Repton, I imagine."
"That is what I was thinking of. As he has done so well by Smith, I think I had better have him at once. His terms are 5 guineas a day."
"Well, and if they were 10, cried Mrs. Norris, "I'm sure you need not regard it. The expense need not be any impediment. If I were you, I should not think of the expense. I would have everything done in the best style, and made as nice as possible. Such a place as Southerton Court deserves everything that taste and money can do. You have space to work upon there, and grounds that will well reward you. For my own part, if I had anything within the 50th part of the size of Southerton, I should be always planting and improving, for naturally I am excessively fond of it. It would be too ridiculous for me to attempt anything where I am now, with my little half acre. It would be quite a burlesque. But if I had more room, I should take a prodigious delight in improving and planting. We did a vast deal in that way at the parsonage, we made it quite a different place from what it was when we first had it. You young ones do not remember much about it, perhaps, but if dear Sir Thomas were here, he could tell you what improvements we made, and a great deal more would have been done, but for poor Mr. Norris's sad state of health. He could hardly ever get out, poor man, to enjoy anything, and that disheartened me from doing several things that Sir Thomas and I used to talk of. If it had not been for that, we should have carried on the garden wall, and made the plantation to shut out the churchyard, just as Dr. Grant has done. We were always doing something as it was. It was only the spring 12 months before Mr. Norris's death that we put in the apricot against the stable wall, which is now grown such a noble tree, and getting to such perfection, sir, addressing herself then to Drive Grant.
"The tree thrives well, beyond a doubt, madam," replied Dr. Grant. "The soil is good, and I never pass it without regretting that the fruit should be so little worth the trouble of gathering."
"Sir, it is a moor park, we bought it as a moor park, and it cost us, that is, it was a present from Sir Thomas, but I saw the bill and I know it cost 7 shillings, and was charged as a moor park."
"You were imposed on, ma'am," replied Dr. Grant, "these potatoes have as much the flavor of a moor park apricot as the fruit from that tree. It is an insipid fruit at the best, but a good apricot is eatable, which none from my garden are."
"The truth is, ma'am," said Mrs. Grant, pretending to whisper across the table to Mrs. Norris, "that Dr. Grant hardly knows what the natural taste of our apricot is. He is scarcely ever indulged with one, for it is so valuable a fruit, with a little assistance, and ours is such a remarkably large, fair sort, that what with early tarts and preserves, my cook contrives to get them all. Mrs. Norris, who had begun to redden, was appeased, and, for a little while, other subjects took place of the improvements of Southerton. Drive Grant and Mrs. Norris were seldom good friends, their acquaintance had begun in dilapidations, and their habits were totally dissimilar. After a short interruption, Mr. Rushworth began again. Smith's Place is the admiration of all the country, and it was a mere nothing before Repton took it in hand. I think I shall have Repton.
Mr. Rushworth, said Lady Bertram, if I were you, I would have a very pretty shrubbery. One likes to get out into a shrubbery in fine weather.
Mr. Rushworth was eager to assure her ladyship of his acquiescence, and tried to make out something complimentary, but, between his submission to her taste, and his having always intended the same himself, with the superadded objects of professing attention to the comfort of ladies in general, and of insinuating that there was one only whom he was anxious to please, he grew puzzled, and Edmund was glad to put an end to his speech by a proposal of wine. Mr. Rushworth, however, though not usually a great talker, had still more to say on the subject next his heart. Smith has not much above 100 acres altogether in his grounds, which is little enough, and makes it more surprising that the place can have been so improved. Now, at Southerton we have a good 700, without reckoning the water meadows, so that I think, if so much could be done at Compton, we need not despair. There have been 2 or 3 fine old trees cut down, that grew too near the house, and it opens the prospect amazingly, which makes me think that Repton, or anybody of that sort, would certainly have the avenue at Southerton down, the avenue that leads from the west front to the top of the hill, you know, turning to Miss Bertram particularly as he spoke. But Miss Bertram thought it most becoming to reply. The avenue? Oh! I do not recollect it. I really know very little of Southerton. Fanny, who was sitting on the other side of Edmund, exactly opposite Miss Crawford, and who had been attentively listening, now looked at him, and said in a low voice, Cut down an avenue. What a pity. Does it not make you think of Cooper? Ye fallen avenues, once more I mourn your fate unmerited. He smiled as he answered, I am afraid the avenue stands a bad chance, Fanny. I should like to see Southerton before it is cut down, to see the place as it is now, in its old state, but I do not suppose I shall. Have you never been there?
No, you never can, and, unluckily, it is out of distance for a ride. I wish we could contrive it.
Oh! It does not signify. Whenever I do see it, you will tell me how it has been altered.
I collect, said Miss Crawford, that Southerton is an old place, and a place of some grandeur.
In any particular style of building?
The house was built in Elizabeth's time, and is a large, regular, brick building, heavy, but respectable looking, and has many good rooms. It is ill-placed. It stands in one of the lowest spots of the park, in that respect, unfavorable for improvement. But the woods are fine, and there is a stream, which, I dare say, might be made a good deal of.
Mr. Rushworth is quite right, I think, in meaning to give it a modern dress, and I have no doubt that it will be all done extremely well. Miss Crawford listened with submission, and said to herself, He is a well-bred man, he makes the best of it.
I do not wish to influence Mr. Rushworth, he continued, but, had I a place to new fashion, I should not put myself into the hands of an improver. I would rather have an inferior degree of beauty, of my own choice, and acquired progressively. I would rather abide by my own blunders than by his. You would know what you were about, of course, but that would not suit me. I have no eye or ingenuity for such matters, but as they are before me, and had I a place of my own in the country, I should be most thankful to any Mr. Repton who would undertake it, and give me as much beauty as he could for my money, and I should never look at it till it was complete.
It would be delightful to me to see the progress of it all, said Fanny.
Eh, you have been brought up to it. It was no part of my education, and the only dose I ever had, being administered by not the first favorite in the world, has made me consider improvements in hand as the greatest of nuisances. 3 years ago the Admiral, my honored uncle, bought a cottage at Twickenham for us all to spend our summers in, and my aunt and I went down to it quite in raptures, but it being excessively pretty, it was soon found necessary to be improved, and for 3 months we were all dirt and confusion, without a gravel walk to step on, or a bench fit for use. I would have everything as complete as possible in the country, shrubberies and flower gardens, and rustic seats innumerable, but it must all be done without my care. Henry is different, he loves to be doing.
Edmund was sorry to hear Miss Crawford, whom he was much disposed to admire, speak so freely of her uncle. It did not suit his sense of propriety, and he was silenced, Till induced by further smiles and liveliness to put the matter by for the present.
"Mr. Bertram," said she, "I have tidings of my harp at last. I am assured that it is safe at Northampton, and there it has probably been these 10 days, in spite of the solemn assurances we have so often received to the contrary."
Edmund expressed his pleasure and surprise. "The truth is, that our inquiries were too direct. We sent a servant, we went ourselves. This will not do 70 miles from London, but this morning we heard of it in the right way. It was seen by some farmer, and he told the miller, and the miller told the butcher, and the butcher's son-in-law left word at the shop. I'm very glad that you have heard of it, by whatever means, and hope there will be no further delay. I am to have it tomorrow, but how do you think it is to be conveyed? Not by a wagon or cart, oh no. Nothing of that kind could be hired in the village. I might as well have asked for porters and a hand-barrow. You would find it difficult, I dare say, just now, in the middle of a very late hay harvest, to hire a horse and cart?" I was astonished to find what a piece of work was made of it. To want a horse and cart in the country seemed impossible, so I told my maid to speak for one directly, and as I cannot look out of my dressing closet without seeing one farmyard, nor walk in the shrubbery without passing another, I thought it would be only ask and have, and was rather grieved that I could not give the advantage to all. Guess my surprise, when I found that I had been asking the most unreasonable, most impossible thing in the world, had offended all the farmers, all the laborers, all the hay in the parish. As for Dr. Grant's bailiff, I believe I had better keep out of his way, and my brother-in-law himself, who is all kindness in general, looked rather black upon me when he found what I had been at. You could not be expected to have thought on the subject before, but when you do think of it, you must see the importance of getting in the grass. The hire of a cart at any time might not be so easy as you suppose. Our farmers are not in the habit of letting them out, but, in harvest, it must be quite out of their power to spare a horse. I shall understand all your ways in time, but, coming down with the true London maxim, that everything is to be got with money, I was a little embarrassed at first by the sturdy independence of your country customs. However, I'm to have my harp fetched tomorrow. Henry, who is good nature itself, has offered to fetch it in his barouche. Will it not be honorably conveyed? Edmund spoke of the harp as his favorite instrument, and hoped to be soon allowed to hear her. Fanny had never heard the harp at all, and wished for it very much. "I shall be most happy to play to you both," said Miss Crawford, "at least as long as you can like to listen, probably much longer, for I dearly love music myself, and where the natural taste is equal the player must always be best off, for she is gratified in more ways than one. Now, Mr. Bertram, if you write to your brother, I entreat you to tell him that my harp is come, he heard so much of my misery about it. And you may say, if you please, that I shall prepare my most plaintive airs against his return, in compassion to his feelings, as I know his horse will lose. If I write, I will say whatever you wish me, but I do not, at present, foresee any occasion for writing. No, I dare say, nor if he were to be gone a twelvemonth, would you ever write to him, nor he to you, if it could be helped. The occasion would never be foreseen. What strange creatures brothers are! You would not write to each other but upon the most urgent necessity in the world, and when obliged to take up the pen to say that such a horse is ill, or such a relation dead, it is done in the fewest possible words. You have but one style among you. I know it perfectly. Henry, who is in every other respect exactly what a brother should be, who loves me, consults me, confides in me, and will talk to me by the hour together, has never yet turned the page in a letter, and very often it is nothing more than "Dear Mary, I am just arrived. Bath seems full, and everything is usual. Yours sincerely." That is the true manly style, that is a complete brother's letter. When they are at a distance from all their family, said Fanny, coloring for William's sake, they can write long letters.
"Miss Price has a brother at sea," said Edmund, "whose excellence as a correspondent makes her think you too severe upon us."
"At sea, has she?"
"In the king's service, of course."
Fanny would rather have had Edmund tell the story, but his determined silence obliged her to relate her brother's situation. Her voice was animated in speaking of his profession, and the foreign stations he had been on, but she could not mention the number of years that he had been absent without tears in her eyes. Miss Crawford civilly wished him an early promotion.
"Do you know anything of my cousin's captain?" said Edmund.
"Captain Marshall? You have a large acquaintance in the navy, I conclude?"
"Among admirals, large enough, but, with an air of grandeur, we know very little of the inferior ranks. Post-captains may be very good sort of men, but they do not belong to us.
Of various admirals I could tell you a great deal, of them and their flags, and the gradation of their pay, and their bickerings and jealousies. But, in general, I can assure you that they are all passed over, and all very ill-used. Certainly, my home at my uncle's brought me acquainted with a circle of admirals. Of rears and vices I saw enough. Now do not be suspecting me of a pun, I entreat. Edmund again felt grave, and only replied, "It is a noble profession."
Yes, the profession is well enough under two circumstances, if it make the fortune, and there be discretion in spending it, but, in short, it is not a favorite profession of mine. It has never worn an amiable form to me.
Edmund reverted to the harp, and was again very happy in the prospect of hearing her play. The subject of improving grounds, meanwhile, was still under consideration among the others, and Mrs. Grant could not help addressing her brother, though it was calling his attention from Miss Julia Bertram.
"My dear Henry, have you nothing to say? You have been an improver yourself, and from what I hear of Everingham, it may vie with any place in England. Its natural beauties, I am sure, are great. Everingham, as it used to be, was perfect in my estimation, such a happy fall of ground, and such timber. What would I not give to see it again?"
"Nothing could be so gratifying to me as to hear your opinion of it," was his answer, "but I fear there would be some disappointment. You would not find it equal to your present ideas. In extent, it is a mere nothing, you would be surprised at its insignificance, and, as for improvement, there was very little for me to do too little, I should like to have been busy much longer."
"You are fond of this sort of thing?" said Julia.
"Excessively, but what with the natural advantages of the ground, which pointed out, even to a very young eye, what little remained to be done, and my own consequent resolutions, I had not been of age 3 months before Everingham was all that it is now. My plan was laid at Westminster, a little altered, perhaps, at Cambridge, and at 21 executed. I am inclined to envy Mr. Rushworth for having so much happiness yet before him. I have been a devourer of my own."
"Those who see quickly, will resolve quickly, and act quickly," said Julia. "You can never want employment. Instead of envying Mr. Rushworth, you should assist him with your opinion."
Mrs. Grant, hearing the latter part of this speech, enforced it warmly, persuaded that no judgment could be equal to her brother's, and as Miss Bertram caught at the idea likewise, and gave it her full support, declaring that, in her opinion, it was infinitely better to consult with friends and disinterested advisers, than immediately to throw the business into the hands of a professional man, Mr. Rushworth was very ready to request the favor of Mr. Crawford's assistance, and Mr. Crawford, after properly depreciating his own abilities, was quite at his service in any way that could be useful. Mr. Rushworth then began to propose Mr. Crawford's doing him the honor of coming over to Southerton, and taking a bed there, when Mrs. Norris, as if reading in her two nieces' minds their little approbation of a plan which was to take Mr. Crawford away, interposed with an amendment. "There can be no doubt of Mr. Crawford's willingness, but why should not more of us go? Why should not we make a little party? Here are many that would be interested in your improvements, my dear Mr. Rushworth, and that would like to hear Mr. Crawford's opinion on the spot, and that might be of some small use to you with their opinions, and, for my own part, I have been long wishing to wait upon your good mother again. Nothing but having no horses of my own could have made me so remiss, but now I could go and sit a few hours with Mrs. Rushworth, while the rest of you walked about and settled things, and then we could all return to a late dinner here, or dine at Southerton, just as might be most agreeable to your mother, and have a pleasant drive home by moonlight. I dare say Mr. Crawford would take my two nieces and me in his barouche, and Edmund can go on horseback, you know, sister, and Fanny will stay at home with you." Lady Bertram made no objection, and everyone concerned in the going was forward in expressing their ready concurrence, excepting Edmund, who heard it all and said nothing.
Chapter 7.
"Well, Fanny, and how do you like Miss Crawford now?" said Edmund the next day, after thinking some time on the subject himself. "How did you like her yesterday?"
"Very well, very much. I like to hear her talk. She entertains me, and she is so extremely pretty, that I have great pleasure in looking at her. It is her countenance that is so attractive. She has a wonderful play of feature. But was there nothing in her conversation that struck you, Fanny, as not quite right?"
"Oh yes. She ought not to have spoken of her uncle as she did. I was quite astonished. An uncle with whom she has been living so many years, and who, whatever his faults may be, is so very fond of her brother, treating him, they say, quite like a son. I could not have believed it. I thought you would be struck. It was very wrong,
very indecorous.
And very ungrateful, I think.
Ungrateful is a strong word. I do not know that her uncle has any claim to her gratitude, his wife certainly had, and it is the warmth of her respect for her aunt's memory which misleads her here. She is awkwardly circumstanced. With such warm feelings and lively spirits, it must be difficult to do justice to her affection for Mrs. Crawford, without throwing a shade on the Admiral. I do not pretend to know which was most to blame in their disagreements, though the Admiral's present conduct might incline one to the side of his wife, but it is natural and amiable that Miss Crawford should acquit her aunt entirely. I do not censure her opinions, but there certainly is impropriety in making them public.
Do not you think, said Fanny, after a little consideration, that this impropriety is a reflection itself upon Mrs. Crawford, as her niece has been entirely brought up by her? She cannot have given her right notions of what was due to the Admiral.
That is a fair remark.
Yes, we must suppose the faults of the niece to have been those of the aunt, and it makes one more sensible of the disadvantages she has been under. But I think her present home must do her good. Mrs. Grant's manners are just what they ought to be. She speaks of her brother with a very pleasing affection.
Yes, except as to his writing her such short letters. She made me almost laugh. But I cannot rate so very highly the love or good nature of a brother who will not give himself the trouble of writing anything worth reading to his sisters, when they are separated. I'm sure William would never have used me so, under any circumstances. And what right had she to suppose that you would not write long letters when you were absent?
The right of a lively mind, Fanny, seizing whatever may contribute to its own amusement or that of others, perfectly allowable, when untinctured by ill humor or roughness, and there is not a shadow of either in the countenance or manner of Miss Crawford, nothing sharp, or loud, or coarse. She is perfectly feminine, except in the instances we have been speaking of. There she cannot be justified. I am glad you saw it all as I did. Having formed her mind and gained her affections, he had a good chance of her thinking like him, though at this period, and on this subject, there began now to be some danger of dissimilarity, for he was in a line of admiration of Miss Crawford, which might lead him where Fanny could not follow. Miss Crawford's attractions did not lessen. The harp arrived, and rather added to her beauty, wit, and good humor, for she played with the greatest obligingness, with an expression and taste which were peculiarly becoming, and there was something clever to be said at the close of every air. Edmund was at the parsonage every day, to be indulged with his favorite instrument, one morning secured an invitation for the next, for the lady could not be unwilling to have a listener, and everything was soon in a fair train. A young woman, pretty, lively, with a harp as elegant as herself, and both placed near a window, cut down to the ground, and opening on a little lawn, surrounded by shrubs in the rich foliage of summer, was enough to catch any man's heart. The season, the scene, the air, were all favorable to tenderness and sentiment. Mrs. Grant and her tambour frame were not without their use, it was all in harmony, and as everything will turn to account when love is once set going, even the sandwich tray, and Dr. Grant doing the honors of it, were worth looking at. Without studying the business, however, or knowing what he was about, Edmund was beginning, at the end of a week of such intercourse, to be a good deal in love, and to the credit of the lady it may be added that, without his being a man of the world or an elder brother, without any of the arts of flattery or the gaieties of small talk, he began to be agreeable to her. She felt it to be so, though she had not foreseen, and could hardly understand it, for he was not pleasant by any common rule, he talked no nonsense, he paid no compliments, his opinions were unbending, his attentions tranquil and simple. There was a charm, perhaps, in his sincerity, his steadiness, his integrity, which Miss Crawford might be equal to feel, though not equal to discuss with herself. She did not think very much about it, however, he pleased her for the present, she liked to have him near her, it was enough. Fanny could not wonder that Edmund was at the parsonage every morning. She would gladly have been there too, might she have gone in uninvited and unnoticed, to hear the harp, neither could she wonder that, when the evening stroll was over, and the two families parted again, he should think it right to attend Mrs. Grant and her sister to their home, while Mr. Crawford was devoted to the ladies of the park, but she thought it a very bad exchange, and if Edmund were not there to mix the wine and water for her, would rather go without it than not. She was a little surprised that he could spend so many hours with Miss Crawford, and not see more of the sort of fault which he had already observed, and of which she was almost always reminded by a something of the same nature whenever she was in her company, but so it was. Edmund was fond of speaking to her of Miss Crawford, but he seemed to think it enough that the Admiral had since been spared, and she scrupled to point out her own remarks to him, lest it should appear like ill nature.
The first actual pain which Miss Crawford occasioned her was the consequence of an inclination to learn to ride, which the former caught, soon after her being settled at Mansfield, from the example of the young ladies at the park, and which, when Edmund's acquaintance with her increased, led to his encouraging the wish, and the offer of his own quiet mare for the purpose of her first attempts, as the best fitted for a beginner that either stable could furnish. No pain, no injury, however, was designed by him to his cousin in this offer. She was not to lose a day's exercise by it. The mare was only to be taken down to the parsonage half an hour before her ride were to begin, and Fanny, on its being first proposed, so far from feeling slighted, was almost overpowered with gratitude that he should be asking her leave for it. Miss Crawford made her first essay with great credit to herself, and no inconvenience to Fanny. Edmund, who had taken down the mare and presided at the hall, returned with it in excellent time, before either Fanny or the steady old coachman, who always attended her when she rode without her cousins, were ready to set forward. The second day's trial was not so guiltless. Miss Crawford's enjoyment of riding was such that she did not know how to leave off. Active and fearless, and though rather small, strongly made, she seemed formed for a horsewoman, and to the pure genuine pleasure of the exercise, something was probably added in Edmund's attendance and instructions, and something more in the conviction of very much surpassing her sex in general by her early progress, to make her unwilling to dismount. Fanny was ready and waiting, and Mrs. Norris was beginning to scold her for not being gone, and still no horse was announced, no Edmund appeared. To avoid her aunt, and look for him, she went out. The houses, though scarcely half a mile apart, were not within sight of each other, but, by walking 50 yards from the hall door, she could look down the park, and command a view of the parsonage and all its demesnes, gently rising beyond the village road, and in Dr. Grant's meadow she immediately saw the group Edmund and Miss Crawford both on horseback, riding side by side, Dr. and Mrs. Grant, and Mr. Crawford, with two or three grooms, standing about and looking on. A happy party it appeared to her, all interested in one object, cheerful beyond a doubt, for the sound of merriment ascended even to her. It was a sound which did not make her cheerful. She wondered that Edmund should forget her, and felt a pang. She could not turn her eyes from the meadow, she could not help watching all that passed. At first Miss Crawford and her companion made the circuit of the field, which was not small, at a foot's pace, then, at her apparent suggestion, they rose into a canter, and to Fanny's timid nature it was most astonishing to see how well she sat. After a few minutes they stopped entirely. Edmund was close to her, he was speaking to her. He was evidently directing her management of the bridle. He had hold of her hand, she saw it, or the imagination supplied what the eye could not reach. She must not wonder at all this. What could be more natural than that Edmund should be making himself useful, and proving his good nature by anyone? She could not but think, indeed, that Mr. Crawford might as well have saved him the trouble, that it would have been particularly proper and becoming in a brother to have done it himself, but Mr. Crawford, with all his boasted good nature, and all his coachmanship, probably knew nothing of the matter, and had no active kindness in comparison of Edmund. She began to think it rather hard upon the mare to have such double duty. If she were forgotten, the poor mare should be remembered. Her feelings for one and the other were soon a little tranquilized by seeing the party in the meadow disperse, and Miss Crawford still on horseback, but attended by Edmund on foot, pass through a gate into the lane, and so into the park, and make towards the spot where she stood. She began then to be afraid of appearing rude and impatient, and walked to meet them with a great anxiety to avoid the suspicion. "My dear Miss Price," said Miss Crawford, as soon as she was at all within hearing, "I am come to make my own apologies for keeping you waiting, but I have nothing in the world to say for myself. I knew it was very late, and that I was behaving extremely ill, and therefore, if you please, you must forgive me. Selfishness must always be forgiven, you know, because there is no hope of a cure." Fanny's answer was extremely civil, and Edmund added his conviction that she could be in no hurry. "For there is more than time enough for my cousin to ride twice as far as she ever goes," said he, "and you have been promoting her comfort by preventing her from setting off half an hour sooner. Clouds are now coming up, and she will not suffer from the heat as she would have done then. I wish you may not be fatigued by so much exercise. I wish you had saved yourself this walk home." "No part of it fatigues me but getting off this horse, I assure you," said she, as she sprang down with his help. "I am very strong. Nothing ever fatigues me but doing what I do not like. Miss Price, I give way to you with a very bad grace, but I sincerely hope you will have a pleasant ride, and that I may have nothing but good to hear of this dear, delightful, beautiful animal." The old coachman,
who had been waiting about with his own horse, now joining them, Fanny was lifted on hers, and they set off across another part of the park, her feelings of discomfort not lightened by seeing, as she looked back, that the others were walking down the hill together to the village, nor did her attendant do her much good by his comments on Miss Crawford's great cleverness as a horsewoman, which he had been watching with an interest almost equal to her own. "It is a pleasure to see a lady with such a good heart for riding," said he. "I never see one sit a horse better." She did not seem to have a thought of fear. "Very different from you, miss, when you first began, 6 years ago come next Easter. Lord bless you. How you did tremble when Sir Thomas first had you put on." In the drawing room Miss Crawford was also celebrated. Her merit in being gifted by nature with strength and courage was fully appreciated by the Miss Bertrams, her delight in riding was like their own, her early excellence in it was like their own, and they had great pleasure in praising it. "I was sure she would ride well," said Julia, "she has the make for it. Her figure is as neat as her brother's." "Yes," added Maria, "and her spirits are as good, and she has the same energy of character. I cannot but think that good horsemanship has a great deal to do with the mind." When they parted at night Edmund asked Fanny whether she meant to ride the next day. "No, I do not know, not if you want the mare," was her answer. "I do not want her at all for myself," said he, "but whenever you are next inclined to stay at home, I think Miss Crawford would be glad to have her a longer time for a whole morning, in short. She has a great desire to get as far as Mansfield Common, Mrs. Grant has been telling her of its fine views, and I have no doubt of her being perfectly equal to it. But any morning will do for this. She would be extremely sorry to interfere with you. It would be very wrong if she did. She rides only for pleasure, you for health." "I shall not ride tomorrow, certainly," said Fanny, "I have been out very often lately, and would rather stay at home. You know I am strong enough now to walk very well." Edmund looked pleased, which must be Fanny's comfort, and the ride to Mansfield Common took place the next morning. The party included all the young people but herself, and was much enjoyed at the time, and doubly enjoyed again in the evening discussion. A successful scheme of this sort generally brings on another, and the having been to Mansfield Common disposed them all for going somewhere else the day after. There were many other views to be shown, and though the weather was hot, there were shady lanes wherever they wanted to go. A young party is always provided with a shady lane. 4 fine mornings successively were spent in this manner, in showing the Crawfords the country, and doing the honors of its finest spots. Everything answered, it was all gaiety and good humor, the heat only supplying inconvenience enough to be talked of with pleasure till the 4th day, when the happiness of one of the party was exceedingly clouded. Miss Bertram was the one. Edmund and Julia were invited to dine at the parsonage, and she was excluded. It was meant and done by Mrs. Grant, with perfect good humor, on Mr. Rushworth's account, who was partly expected at the park that day, but it was felt as a very grievous injury, and her good manners were severely taxed to conceal her vexation and anger till she reached home. As Mr. Rushworth did not come, the injury was increased, and she had not even the relief of showing her power over him. She could only be sullen to her mother, aunt, and cousin, and throw as great a gloom as possible over their dinner and dessert. Between 10 and 11 Edmund and Julia walked into the drawing room, fresh with the evening air, glowing and cheerful, the very reverse of what they found in the three ladies sitting there, for Maria would scarcely raise her eyes from her book, and Lady Bertram was half asleep, and even Mrs. Norris, discomposed by her niece's ill humor, and having asked one or two questions about the dinner, which were not immediately attended to, seemed almost determined to say no more. For a few minutes the brother and sister were too eager in their praise of the night and their remarks on the stars, to think beyond themselves, but when the first pause came, Edmund, looking around, said, "But where is Fanny? Is she gone to bed?"
"No, not that I know of," replied Mrs. Norris, "she was here a moment ago." Her own gentle voice speaking from the other end of the room, which was a very long one, told them that she was on the sofa. Mrs. Norris began scolding. "That is a very foolish trick, Fanny, to be idling away all the evening upon a sofa. Why cannot you come and sit here, and employ yourself as we do? If you have no work of your own, I can supply you from the poor basket. There is all the new calico, that was bought last week, not touched yet. I'm sure I almost broke my back by cutting it out. You should learn to think of other people, and, take my word for it, it is a shocking trick for a young person to be always lolling upon a sofa." Before half this was said, Fanny was returned to her seat at the table, and had taken up her work again, and Julia, who was in high good humor, from the pleasures of the day, did her the justice of exclaiming,
I must say, ma'am, that Fanny is as little upon the sofa as anybody in the house.
Fanny, said Edmund, after looking at her attentively, I am sure you have the headache.
She could not deny it, but said it was not very bad.
I can hardly believe you, he replied, I know your looks too well.
How long have you had it?
Since a little before dinner.
It is nothing but the heat.
Did you go out in the heat?
Go out.
To be sure she did, said Mrs. Norris, would you have her stay within such a fine day as this? Were not we all out? Even your mother was out today for above an hour.
Yes, indeed, Edmund, added her ladyship, who had been thoroughly awakened by Mrs. Norris's sharp reprimand to Fanny, I was out above an hour. I sat 3/4 of an hour in the flower garden, while Fanny cut the roses, and very pleasant it was, I assure you, but very hot. It was shady enough in the alcove, but I declare I quite dreaded the coming home again.
Fanny has been cutting roses, has she?
Yes, and I am afraid they will be the last this year.
Poor thing. She found it hot enough, but they were so full-blown that one could not wait.
There was no help for it, certainly, rejoined Mrs. Norris, in a rather softened voice, but I question whether her headache might not be caught then, sister. There is nothing so likely to give it as standing and stooping in a hot sun, but I dare say it will be well tomorrow. Suppose you let her have your aromatic vinegar, I always forget to have mine filled.
She has got it, said Lady Bertram, she has had it ever since she came back from your house the second time.
What? Cried Edmund, has she been walking as well as cutting roses, walking across the hot park to your house, and doing it twice, ma'am? No wonder her head aches.
Mrs. Norris was talking to Julia, and did not hear.
I was afraid it